Hello and welcome to episode 4.5 of SourceCast. I'm JD.
And I'm Jeremy.
And this episode, it's a 0.5 episode similar to what we did with episode Pi a couple of weeks ago. And in this episode, we're just going to be talking about, Jeremy tried Vista for the first time, so we're going to be doing a unofficial review of Vista. We're going to be tackling some viewer feedback and discussing Linux standards. First up, viewer feedback. We got an email into our email, jd@sourcecast.org and jeremy@sourcecast.org. Could you explain the Gmail Equifax certificate thingy, which nearly caused an unanticipated soiling during my configuration of Evolution on Debian testing? What exactly does Gmail have to do with Equifax? Signed, Havel? I'm sorry, that looks like Polish or something. Well, what Gmail has to do with Equifax is, as I think anyone who set up Gmail in a third-party client knows, it uses SSL. And they choose, not that there's much of a choice since there's only about two of them, they choose to get their SSL certificate from Equifax. By default, what did you say you were using? Evolution should realize that Equifax is a certified place to get an SSL certificate from and just let it pass on by. But apparently they don't do that. They don't have a list of certificate authority places in there. So it bugs you and asks, you know, is this an okay certificate? Pretty much, if it's a site you trust, like Gmail, there's a pretty good chance you're safe just saying okay. If it's like, you know, shop@joescomputerstore.com, where you're putting in your credit card information and you've never heard of them and they have a, you know, bad SSL certificate, then it's time to start worrying a little bit. But for Gmail and Evolution, it's no big deal. It's not an email, it's actually a comment that we got posted to SourceCast Episode 4 from Chris Bumgardner. Said, I like your podcast, but why is it that you trash everything that you review? I mean, you two simply burn Foresight at the stake. Yeah, we did. We kind of did. You're right to do so if it is really that bad, but how about a change of pace? Could you review something that you actually like? I'm all for giving honest feedback in hopes that things will improve, but if a Windows user were to listen to your podcast, they would conclude that Linux must suck because you only say bad things about it. You want to go first on this one, Jeremy?
Sure. I'll read the exact response I gave to him, and that is, some of our criteria are very tough to be good at the same time. For example, Gentoo, incredible for power users and servers. Granny will never, ever figure out how to install it.
If Granny can install Arch, she's not going to be able to install Gentoo. That's not happening.
And the reverse is true of Ubuntu. And this is why there are so many distributions of Linux to begin with. A lot of them are purpose-built and highly targeted. And, you know, some of them work given what they're designed for. And I think we've gushed a fair amount over the Ubuntu's upsides, like hardware support in their community, and Arch's good side, like PKG builds and community in their website and so on. Just that it's very hard to get straight tens across the board, given the just number of things that we're grading on. It's very hard to be good at all those things at the same time. And Let's face it, for some of the more obscure distros we're looking at, they simply don't have the manpower to accomplish some of these things. And, you know, I don't hold it against them that much, but it's not like they're not trying to become the next Ubuntu.
Right. And, you know, everyone has to remember, you know, Ubuntu is almost 4 years old now, and, you know, they're really not doing any upstream work that much. And, you know, like, they're packaging GNOME 2.24 when only GNOME 2.22 is in Debian, but they get to do a lot of, you know, making things easier work. They don't have to concentrate on packaging everything. So, and really, the reason we bag on so many distros is because, as Jeremy mentioned, there is no one perfect distro for everyone. Like, you know, I like Ubuntu, sure. And I use it sometimes when I'm feeling lazier, when I need to get a full GUI in about 20 minutes. But I just I don't want to run it as my desktop OS, and it will fail our criteria because it's not aimed at advanced users. And the distros that we've epically ripped a new asshole, which is mainly OpenSUSE and Foresight, we're not judging them just because, you know, oh, it's Foresight. We're judging them fairly. And if, you know, Foresight took apt and implemented their transactional stuff on top of apt, I would be more than happy to, you know, forgive everything that sucked about their package manager, because pretty much nothing would suck about it.
Yeah, we're harsh, but at the same time, we're fairly straightforward and honest. I think I said that if SUSE just got rid of their software manager, just threw it out the window, and replaced it with deb files and apt-get, it would be heavenly. It would be incredible. It would be what Ubuntu strives to be. That would be the closest distro we have reviewed to this point in terms of getting straight tens across the board. It would have probably averaged, if OpenSUSE had apt-get instead of their existing software manager, I imagine I would have given it a total average of probably north of 8, 8.5, and I think our highest right now is Arch around 7.5.
Yeah, I think so. And also, Chris, I don't know, you may listen to other podcasts like Linux Action Show or Lug Radio or distros like that, where they basically are like, you know, the distro did this, 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 and this well, but I had a couple little issues, and, you know, like, if the thing segfaults on boot, they call that a little issue. I call that a pretty big fucking issue.
Your shipment of fail has arrived.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things, at least me personally, both in real life and in this show, I try not to beat around the bush and say, you know, like, oh, it's a good distro if they just, you know, tried a little bit hard. No, the distro sucks, you know, change shit, or it's going to keep sucking.
And despite the fact that we really ripped Foresight a new asshole, we had the community manager for Foresight and a former developer for Foresight post on our forums and basically say, hey, we agree with you guys on most of what you said. And the community manager said, hey, we'll take this into consideration and work to make it better. And that's what we really want to get out of this.
Yeah, that is, honestly, I completely agree there. That is the best thing that we want to get out of this. Now you know, by listening to this podcast, what kind of sucks about your distro, and you can improve it.
And yeah, and it's not like we're going to be, I mean, we're very honest, we're very fair, but it's not like we're going to be nice. We're not going to go put these on some 5-year-old ThinkPads or some Dells that originally shipped with Ubuntu. We're going to put it on some evil-ass hardware and see what it's got.
Yeah, I mean, you know, even if we were to review my current distro of choice, Debian, I wouldn't be able to give it, like, you know, I wouldn't be able to give it, you know, tens on everything. Hell, it would probably score within maybe half a point of Arch Linux. You know. And it's one of those things of, like, there is no perfect distro. It's more or less, you know, if you're a new user, go with whatever distro we give the highest, you know, like Granny rating, and software selection too. If you're a power user, go with the distro we give, you know, the highest power user, software selection, and, you know, I can't think of a third criteria that would be good, but...
Performance.
Whether for that third... Performance, sure. You know. It's more or less... Yes, we hate on everything, but... Yeah, we yeah.
Well, we hate on everything, but if it's good, you know, we will speak of it as such. I gushed a fair amount over SUSE before I ripped it a new asshole for the software manager. Like I said, if they would just use apt-get and Debian, I would have a hard-on for SUSE. It would be that good.
Yeah. I mean, hell, even, you know, like I said, even our distros of choice, for me, Debian, for you, Arch Linux, and or Gentoo, we wouldn't be able to give it, you know, 10 out of 10. You know, or even the distro that I used to be working on, I quit that distro. Even that, we still wouldn't be able to give it a 10 out of 10 on. But we also got a second comment that I have not pushed to the site yet because I'm too lazy to click the approve button. It will be on the site by the time you're listening to this, though. From a guy named T.S. said, "Hi, I agree with Chris. Your podcast is very negative at times. Just say that something needs more work. You don't have to drone on about it being an epic fail wrapped in a layer of stupidity. Blah, blah, whatever. T.S." You're right, but we do what the distro developers like, in that we explain what we dislike about it, and we mostly say wrapped in the layer of fail and stuff like that, kind of for comedic purpose.
Hey, it's good at getting attention. I mean, to use the, if you will, bad analogy because it's sports, and I imagine not many people who listen to this podcast are big sports fans, but I bet you when Bobby Knight... I bet you when...
racist!
I bet you when Bobby Knight threw his chair across the basketball court, he got the ref's attention.
I think it's time to go on a fun little ride, and it's time for the Vista review.
Oh boy, out of the frying
let's
pan into the oven.
This. Yeah, let's preface this with Chris and TS. If you thought we were hard on Foresight, sweet Jesus.
Oh, dear. Basically, I had a machine I was setting up for an employee at work, and it came with Vista Home Business, or excuse me, Vista Business Professional. Hell, fuck, I can't tell. There's like 20 different versions of Vista, and the only difference between them, aside from the buried at the bottom of the box description features, is one word in the fucking name.
Yeah.
But I digress. It was one of the Vista Business versions. And it was... Oh, fuck, slow. It ran as slow as SUSE's software package manager did all the fucking time. And we're not talking about, you know, a Pentium 2 with 64 megs of RAM here. We're talking about a brand new Dell Latitude with a Centrino 2 Duo and 2 gigs of RAM, absolutely choking and sputtering at every turn.
Because I ran Vista back when it first came out, and I don't know if I said this on episode 1 or not, but Vista was actually what made me make the move to Linux full-time. It actually, for about a week, it did run faster than XP on my system.
It was that slow out of the box for me. There was no reprieve. And when you first start Vista, you get Vista Gadgets. And Vista Gadgets are like KDE 4.1 widgets or the OSX, I forget what you call them, what, scriptlets, applets, whatever?
Yeah, widgets, dashboard widgets.
Yeah, it's just like that in OS X and widgets in KDE 4.1, only none
Except
of them are fucking
really
useful.
And it's done really badly because you have no choice but to have them at the right edge of your screen. You can't move them around randomly. They're in a little bar on the right side of your screen, and if you don't like it, turn them off entirely.
And that brings me to my next point. Turning them off entirely. It took like 10 minutes to figure out how to make them go all the fuck away. They don't make it very easy or obvious. There's a little widgets button down there at the bottom, and you think, oh, well, I'll just click on that and go to disable or something like that. No. You can't get to go away like that. If you hover over the gadget, a little X will appear in the top right. You can get rid of it. And I did that for all of them. But it took me like another 5 to 10 minutes to figure out how to get rid of the fucking Google search widget. And really, what the hell is the point of that? I mean, is the search bar in Firefox and Opera and IE simply not convenient enough?
Yeah, I would somewhat agree with you, but you know, why do people on Macs, let's say, use like widgets for getting movie times? Isn't it, by your logic, it would be easy enough to open up Firefox or Safari or whatever?
Oh no, you know, this is just a simple Google search box. It saves you nothing. You have to go into the browser anyway. You're saving like a double click on the desktop. That's it.
This is true.
And amusingly, the first time I turned it on, I got a nice warning in the bottom right saying, multiple security problems. Well, it's Windows, no shit.
Yeah.
And so
your security problem is the fact that you're running Windows.
And so I did that, and I ended up having to install, like, I don't know, 40 Vista security updates. A lot of them, by the way, the same updates you would get in XP. That should tell you something for Vista sharing code base and where the bloat's coming from. Yeah. And get this, after I installed the security updates, I had to wait as it did further processing when I shut down. And I had to wait for like 5 minutes. And yeah. I turned it back on. And I had to wait another 5 minutes while it did further processing. And I said, oh, okay, well, it must be done now. Wrong! I logged in, multiple security problems. And I had to do this whole song and dance again. And in fact, after I did it the second time, one more time for good measure. You can't use Vista for more than, say a half hour, without stumbling into UAC.
A half hour? Really? I'd give it about 5 minutes.
Well, yeah, you get one as soon as you try and do a security update. So, yeah, probably 5 minutes. I think you get one the first time you run anything on the desktop as well. So if you try to pull up a browser, you'll get one. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I think you get one the first time you open the control panel too, because, you know, geeks, what do we do? The first thing we do is go to the control panel and fuck with settings.
It is absolutely deplorable. To give you an example, it would be like using the Conqueror web browser, when Conqueror 3.x, and every time a website tried to set a cookie, it gave you an allow or deny button. And your only option was to simply, and it didn't give you a way to simply allow all or set further settings. It just gave you an allow or deny every time you got to a website with a cookie. That's kind of like using Vista. Anytime you do anything, continue or deny. And so, of course, after a day or so of using Vista, you get fucking fed up with the bullshit and you just click continue, 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 continue. Which means that when you actually get a virus that's trying to infect your machine, what are you going to do? Continue, 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 continue.
Thus negating all security advantages of UAC.
Yeah, that's a complete design and implementation cop-out from Microsoft. Get some balls and fix the code, Redmond. That's such bullshit.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, they tried to copy sudo in Linux or the way of asking you for your password when you need to, like, install something from a .pkg in OS X, except they failed really horribly at it.
Also, and amusingly, you can't even shut down Vista easily. When you go to the start menu and you click on the little power button, it hibernates. Okay, what the fuck? So you bring it back up from hibernation and you go, okay, so where's the real shutdown button? And on the phone, bottom right, there's a little right arrow. Because when I think shutdown or restart, like, it will sit, like, and of course, after you do an update, the Windows Update Manager sits in the tray like a Jack Russell fucking terrier, jumping up and down, saying, hey, you need to restart, you need to restart, you need to restart. And so, of course, you have to go find how to restart. See, this is very fun. It's like boxing with your computer. And there's a little right arrow button, because when I think restart, I think right arrow button. And after you click the right arrow button, then you get the full listing of options like shut down and restart and hibernate. Who the hell made this decision?
When you click that little right button, you get the full menu of, you know, shut down, restart, hibernate. The shutdown, or perhaps it's restart, by default, if there are still security updates, it you know, does security updates and then shut down. And it just below it has a little bit, you know, a little line of hard to read text, you know, click here if you'd rather shut down without doing updates. It's like, I just want to shut the hell down. Why can't you bug me about my updates via that thing in the tray fucking later?
Yes, I want to know who made these user interface decisions at Redmond so I can hit them in the nuts repeatedly with a titanium-faced golf driver. Here's another bit of absolute bleeding from the asshole pain. If you take a external hard drive, put it in your external hard drive case, and plug it in with USB into your computer, obviously that drive has nothing on it. Nothing. It's totally pristine. And Vista doesn't even do anything. It doesn't say, hey, you plugged in a drive. Want to format it? No. It just acts like nothing happened. And apparently, being able to pull up my computer and look at the drives and right-click on them and go to properties and then format or something like that, apparently, that's too simple. So now you have to right-click on my computer in the start menu, and then you have to go to some other sub-menu and or something like services or manage my computer.
Management. Yeah.
And then after you, there's not even something as simple as disk management. You have to go to something like services or manage my computer or some lame generic bullshit. And that pulls up like a secondary control panel. It doesn't look like the normal control panel. It's something else entirely. And one of the little options you can choose is disk management. And so after you've spent the several minutes to fucking find that, probably by using Google, you can't just click on the drive and format it. If you do, it won't do it. It doesn't give you an error. It doesn't say why. It just fucking doesn't do it. You have to specifically go out of your way to create the master boot record on the drive and then format it. Why the fuck are you making me do this? There's no point in that. If you see that the drive is blank, simply do it all in one shot like you have been for the last decade. Why was this done?
I think the Vista developers hated everybody. They were just, you know, antisocial kind of assholes. And they decided, you know what? Let's be dicks. And let's make this the hardest OS for anyone to use ever.
And, of course, I had to set up network shares and network printers on this machine. And network printers is pretty much identical to XP, even looks the same. They probably haven't even touched that code. But adding a network share is a whole new ball game. There's no My Network. There's no way to sort of browse the network and see what's out there. Instead, you are given a button to click in the GUI which, by the way, is very hidden. It's where you would expect a tab to be if when you were in, you know, my control panel. There's a tab. It's like a network place or something like that. And it's in the position you would expect to be if it was like an Internet Explorer tab. It's not exactly out there and obvious. And when you click on it, it's nothing more than a GUI front end to the net use command. And for those unfamiliar with that, if you are using Windows XP and trying to authenticate to a Samba share on a Linux server, and you're not logging in to that Linux server with the exact same username that the current user is logged in with XP and the exact same password they have in XP, you have to pull up MS-DOS and put in a command called net space use space and then the drive letter you want to mount this net share as, and then colon, then another space, and then backslash the host name, or since Windows is more incompetent, the IP address, and then another backslash, and then the share name. And that's the only way that in Windows XP you can authenticate to a Linux Samba share using a username and password different from the one you're logged in on XP. Because after you press enter on and DOS on that, it'll say, logged in as guest, failed. Do you want to log in as somebody else? Well, fucking yeah, I'm in DOS, aren't I? And so basically in Vista, they gutted all of the sort of helpful gooiness of my network places and instead just put in a GUI front end to the net use command, which is sort of a step forward if you are, say, a system administrator and you already know what all the information is on all the network shares and you don't want to go through the trouble of the username and passwords on the boxes, which I had to go through that. It's not fun. But for a Joe Blow user trying to get the printer that they just right-clicked on and went to share printer, they're not going to have much fucking fun.
You.
And so that was about the totality of my Vista experience. I several times got up and walked away from the computer and went to using my new ThinkPad with Arch while it did security updates and other things like that. Otherwise, I would have ran the risk of putting my fist through the display of that Dell, because it was fucking infuriating to use. Holy shit.
Oh, and there's one thing I want to bring up. If either your computer can't run them, or you choose to turn them off because they do rape your GPU, rape your CPU, and rape your RAM, I'm talking about the Aero graphics here, if you can't already tell. The UI either looks Aero, which uses up all your resources, or it looks like shit. You know.
Yes, Aero, so you can scroll through blue screens, black screens, red screens, and endless yes or no security warnings in eye-popping 3D.
Yeah. It's great in theory. Like, I don't like Compiz. I don't like it on by default. I don't use it unless I'm, you know, showing off to somebody. This is like Compiz, except fewer effects, and it eats about four times the amount of RAM of Compiz.
It's Compiz with one effect and 10 times the overhead. All right.
Yeah, that's excellent. I fail at Simpsons voices, obviously. I'm not going to do that again for you to you people. Yeah, so that's how much Vista sucks, and aren't we mostly glad that we all run Linux?
Yes, if I had to rate out Vista, it would probably be like 0.25 average. I would just mercilessly thrash it.
Wow, that's pretty bad.
Yeah, but it installs cleanly. 1 point. The end.
Yeah. Installs. Everything else sucks. But on to our next topic. Linux standards.
Or lack thereof.
Now, or lack thereof, indeed. Anyone who's been around Linux the past couple of years knows about... It's a package in some distros. Some distros don't have it. It really depends. A package called Linux Standards Base. Basically, it's supposed to say, okay, if you want to be a standard Linux distro, you install these packages, you use this package manager, and you use this directory structure, which, in theory, it's a great idea. Except the last major revision to LSB was in about 2004, before any distros used live CDs, before Firefox 1.0 came out. Very old, very early Linux, it feels like. And also, it recommends, well, actually, the only package manager that is LSB approved is LSB, or is RPM. I'm having an off day, obviously. Is RPM. And
that's mind numbing.
What was that?
That's mind numbing. Why? Just why?
Yeah. As we'll probably show next week, RPM is still made of fail. Because next week we're reviewing Fedora. Never mind. And it's just, why can't... I don't get why nobody has, like, thought up or nobody has, you know, all gotten, let's say, the RPM and Yum and dev and app developers into a room and said, you know, hey, let's come together, make a great package manager that's got the speed of RPM, it's got the, you know, reasonably easy to use and good dependency management of dev, and we'll have a great package manager and we won't be divided between people who love dev and people who love RPM and, you know, people like, you know, cPanel and Plesk who only distribute RPMs because they don't see Debian-based distros as a worthy distro for their tools.
And probably to a lesser extent, just plain lack of resources and ignorance and only so much time to get it out the door as usual.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not only package managers that have that issue. It's package managers, it's, you know, text editors. Really, the list goes on, and I don't understand why no one can agree on something good.
I would take a different approach. Instead of trying to meet a middle ground with all the distros regarding package management, and let's be honest here for a second, the Linux Foundation will be largely dominated by the corporate presences within Linux because they're the people who are funding the damn thing, and that means it's going to be RPM because all the big corporates are RPM. Period. That's just the way life is right now. And I think the better solution would be to take one step higher and to create a new sort of liaison package manager. It's not a package manager in and of itself.
Well, that already exists.
Well, okay. In what form? Are you talking about Smart?
No. I'm talking about PackageKit.
I've never heard of this. Go on.
I'm surprised. Oh yeah, you didn't get to a GUI in Foresight. That would make sense why you have never used it. Basically, what it's meant to be is it's meant to be a front end to it. I believe it has both a command line and a GUI interface, although I've only used the GUI interface. It's meant to be a one front end that's the same on every distro that support. It supports RPM and Yum. It supports Connery in Foresight. It's supposedly it supports Deb, but the last time I tried it, The dev support was horribly lacking to the point where it can install and it can remove, and that's all it can do.
How about Pac-Man?
No Pac-Man backend yet, but apparently, from what I've heard, people are working on one. But there is, like, I think there's a smart backend. There's a PISI backend for Pardis Linux. There's a backend for Mandriva's URMPI thingy.
We forgot to come up with a funny nickname for that. Damn us.
Yeah.
But yes, that's what I would call sexy. Now that will solve so many problems. Just one sort of sitting on top interface that can go and interface with apt-get, go interface with Mandriva and Pac-Man and Yum and whatever the hell SUSE's using this release. That is perfect. Then you can have people like Adobe, who, by the way, recently joined the Linux Foundation, and then, you know, these are the people we really want supporting Linux to begin with. People like, you know, Skype, for instance, because what Skype does right now is they go, well, here's an RPM, fuck you, go fix it for your distro, we're not going to support all of you. We don't have the time or the resources. And now, instead of just throwing out an RPM and saying, go fix it if you don't use RPM, they can release one package, and it will work with every distro.
That's not the way PackageKit works. It's still devs, it's still, you know, RPMs, it's still whatever actual packages that Mandriva uses. It's just, instead of, you know, having to, let's say I'm a Debian user and I want to move to Fedora, having to learn Yum, if I know PackageKit, I can handle installing and removing packages easily on any distro that PackageKit supports.
Okay, we're talking two different things here. You're talking about just a universal front end that doesn't do anything more. It simply calls up the program. I'm talking about one format that supports both binary and source-based, that then properly interfaces with apt-get and yum and RPM and all the others, so that depending on what system it's resident on, it alters the package on the fly and then prepares it and installs it on that distro. That's what I'm talking about. And that would be sexy. Like,
something like auto-package.
Yeah, I know there's a similar effort out there in Smart Package Manager, but that doesn't aim to be a universal thing. It aims to be a complete, you know, front-out replacement. I'm wanting something that just sits one level higher that'll work on any distro, because then you can have somebody like Adobe and Skype make one package, and it'll work on any distro that supports it. And that's real progress for standards.
That's what auto-package supposedly can do, but, you know, auto-package files are really hard to create, and they just don't work well. And if auto-package, if they did something, I don't know what they could do, but if they did something to fix it and make it more like, you know, a normal package that's easy enough to create, you know, Adobe, Skype, they would all use it.
I mean, we don't even have to go straight to this sort of one layer higher package manager that does everything. Even just a program that I can, as a, you know, third-party vendor, fill out my dependencies, fill out my version information and a description and everything, and press a button, and then it spits out a deb, and it spits out an RPM, and it spits out a PKG build. Even that would be huge progress.
Well, that you can cheat with that. There's something, at least on Debian, called, and I think it's on RPM-based distros as well, but I'm not sure, called Alien, that's designed to basically, let's say you make a deb, you build the deb, you run alien --RPM, and then the file name of the deb, and it creates an RPM. And you go, you know, alien --2 targz, the name of the deb, and it creates a Slackware package that I think is backward compatible with Arch, but don't quote me on that. And what would be perfect is to just change that so it adds more formats like ebuilds and package builds and official Arch Linux packages, and you're done, you know. That all you have to do is make one package and run it through Alien for the others.
And it seems to me that is the sort of thing that the Linux Foundation should be working and focusing on. I understand that corporate interests are going to drive the thing, but come on now. And the decision to basically require RPM to be quote-unquote LSB compliant, that's nothing more than, you know, throwing away like a half to two-thirds of Linux out there and saying, well, fuck you, use RPM or go away.
Yeah, pretty much. And I mean, also by using that, they're throwing away literally the most popular Linux distribution in history since Linux has existed, which would be Ubuntu.
And the other standards pet peeve I have, and I'm going to hammer Fedora on this just because at least when I last used Fedora, at least before I will this week for our next review, was around Fedora Core 4 or 5, and I remember it had the most ridiculous path for a config file I have ever seen. I would like to see standards for config file locations and for naming conventions of daemons and things like that. For example, if I want to start Apache in Gentoo, it's /init.d/apache2. And if I want to do that in Arch, it's /rc.d/, and then I think just Apache, maybe httpd. I'm a little hazy. But anyway,
yeah.
And then in Fedora, it's like /init.d/httpd. And that's just really annoying. And they do this shit for like all the daemons too. Like in Gentoo, it's /init.d/mysql. And then in Arch, I know this one for a fact, it's /rc.d/mysqld. That shit's annoying.
Yeah, I'll agree there. But as for your thing about the config file, the way it does it, it doesn't make me happy, but it's better than what you were probably thinking of. It is in Etsy. In Etsy, it's kind of like Pac-Man. There's a yum.conf, and then there's a yum.conf.d with all your repo URLs in it.
Yeah, the particular path I'm going to pick on Fedora is like Fedora Core 4 or 5 back at the time. It was like /etc/, and then it was like web, and then /local, and then /apache/httpd.com. That may just been, you know, the sort of tweaked way that the host I was using did it, but holy shit, was that annoying. And you could imagine the time it took me to find the damn thing. Because, of course, because at the time I was fairly big noob on server stuff, and I just said, okay, locate Apache. And, of course, it'll just show me the Apache folder name there, so I still didn't know where the config file was. And that's so annoying. That's one of the few things that I really like about Gentoo on the server. They will modify where a package saves its config files. They will force that to put it in /etc, and then usually there will be a folder name that mirrors the package name or the daemon name in etc, and then you can go in there and all the stuff is in there.
Right.
I know that by default MySQL wants /etc/my.cnf, and Gentoo said, no the hell you're not, /etc/mysql/my.cnf. And I'm super anal retentive with how I organize my computer. It's just, I can't help it. You know, my room can be, you know, a 3-alarm fire disaster, but by God, my computer is going to be organized just so.
Yeah.
And that's just so annoying. And I don't know, and the Linux Foundation really does nothing to address naming conventions or location saving conventions.
And I mean, isn't this what like things like Linux Fest and Linux Fest Northwest? Isn't this what the entire point of them is supposed to be doing? You know, instead of like DebConf and Fedora's little convention thingy that I think they have, and you know whatever else, one big convention where all the distro people go, and you discuss, you know, making things standard because all distros are there. You know.
Well, it depends on your definition of Linux Fest. At least the ones that I'm familiar with tend to be super duper community oriented.
Although this will be changing in 2 weeks, and I will unofficially make the announcement here because I can and I know things.
I know where you're going, and I that's a good announcement too.
Yes.
And go ahead.
Well, I'll say it here, I guess. This is official from one of the developers who will not be named. Steam and the Source engine, so Counter-Strike Source, Half-Life 2,
Portal. Yes. The cake is a lie.
I don't know too many other source-based games, but you all get the idea. Is coming native to Linux on September the 14th.
I'll finally get to play Team Fortress natively. Spy, sapping my sentry.
And, again, according to the developer, it is a little bit faster on Linux compared to Windows.
Win.
Yes. And to make people a little bit more disappointed, I gotta throw this out there. It was all the graphics for the games, or what the Source engine was actually rewritten in, was SDL, not native OpenGL, but SDL is decent, I guess.
Well, SDL's easier to code in, and Iculus has done a superb job with a lot of the SDL code.
Yeah. And the Steam GUI will be written in written in Qt4.
Hell yes.
Yes, except so many distros and so many people use GNOME. It's like, damn it, why? Oh, yeah. I mean, I probably know why. I mean, I believe this is just, you know, personal. I didn't get this from my developer friend. I believe that the source engine is written in C++. So it was a little bit easier to build a GUI for Steam in C++ instead of, you know, having to keep the core in C++ and then write the GUI in C and then write like a little translate. Just, you know, not worth the extra work.
Excellent. That is a huge announcement. That's progress there. Okay. Do you have any other pet peeves with standards? I think between naming conventions and the lack of a package format that can be easily translated to all distros, those are pretty much my pet peeves with standards. I know that almost all distros, even ones like Gentoo, are pretty much POSIX compliant, and if they're not, it's so close as to not make a difference anyway. I know that Apple made a big deal about masturbating themselves when they got POSIX compliance for OS X, but, you know, what do you fucking do? It's POSIX. Well, doesn't make a big deal for big app developers.
Well, they didn't get I believe it's pronounced POSIX. Not important, I guess. But they did have POSIX compliance before, but now they got officially recognized by the Unix Foundation, you know, the people who were behind, like, BSD and some of the really big shit from back in the day, said basically, okay, Mac OS X is a certified Unix operating system, according to us.
POSIX, you are indeed correct, sir. My bad.
No problem. But yeah, and what makes that a really bad statement is OS X is Unix certified. Linux is not.
Yeah, it pretty much is. The only difference there is going to be that if you say the word Linux, you're referring to so damn many distros, and I'm assuredly some of them aren't. But if you're developing,
well, no, you're referring to the Linux kernel, and the Linux kernel is not Unix compliant according to the Unix group or whoever the hell they are.
They can blow me. If you're developing a Unix app, it's going to work in Linux. It's just going to.
Yeah, and it's pretty much, I think, the fact that like no Linux developer has paid them $50,000 to say that Linux is Unix compliant, because really nobody who is a Linux developer or who has that kind of money who's into Linux really gives a crap.
Yeah, and for those who don't know anything about POSIX, it's a really just ridiculously simple standard. Like, POSIX 1 is like process creation and control, errors, illegal instructions, seg faults. POSIX B is like priority scheduling, real-time capabilities, shared memory, asynchronous and synchronous I/O, and the highest one, which is POSIX C, 1C is nothing more than all that with thread extensions. I mean, we're talking some primitive stuff here, stuff that any operating system that's Unix-based has had since the mid-90s.
Yeah. And I like that Windows is actually not even POSIX compliant unless you install the Microsoft Windows Services for Unix.
Yeah.
Actually, I did not know this. FreeBSD, Linux, well, actually, all the BSDs in Linux are not fully POSIX compliant.
Yeah, they're quote-unquote mostly POSIX compliant, but that's a load of bullshit.
Yeah.
Besides, if you look at, frankly, if you look at the number of people who are, quote, 100%, unquote, POSIX compliant, it reads like a graveyard of operating systems.
Yeah, and it reads like, you know, companies who, you know, when they did make these operating systems, had a couple million dollars in the bank, so that might be hinting at something.
AIX, Minix, OpenSolaris, HPUX, IRIX, yeah, basically people who are dead.
Yeah. Really, the only three that matter, are OS X, Solaris, and Open Solaris, and VxWorks.
Yeah.
Which is surprising because apparently, according to this, my WRT54G is fully POSIX compliant. That's a little bit sad. But I think what makes Linux not POSIX compliant, although we've gotten a little bit off topic here, what makes it not POSIX compliant is because the Linux kernel supports like uclibc and dietlibc, and those aren't POSIX compliant, but libc6 that is used on every distro that's not meant for embedded devices is POSIX compliant.
Load of bullshit.
Yeah, pretty much.
But do you have any other standardization beefs to discuss other than those that we have covered?
I don't think so.
So until next time, if you want to contact us, you can get us through the usual methods. Email jeremy@sourcecast.org.
jd@sourcecast.org.
And feel free to stop by on the forums and let us know what you think. We still have our poll up and running on whether or not you'd like to see this become a video podcast. As obviously you can tell, we're going to continue along with these 0.5 releases. Yep. And as always, you can also get us in the IRC channel at irc.sourcecast.org/sourcecast, and we're both idling in there pretty much all the time. And so until next time, if you want to get Xorg updated, just have us come on and bitch about it, because This week, Mesa 7.1 was released, and now Xorg 7.4 will finally come out about a year late. So, if your software project is behind on release, give us a ring, we'll bitch about it, and you'll get an update.
Thank you for listening to Hacker Public Radio. HPR is sponsored by Caro.net, so head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.